From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, one of the Arab world's leading women novelists, Hanan El-Sheikh. Her first novel, published in 1986 and just published in the U.S., has been banned in several Arab countries for its treatment of sexual and political issues. Also, in this time of AIDS, as we also face a growing tuberculosis epidemic, what can we learn from how the tuberculosis epidemic was handled in the 19th century? We talk with Sheila Rothman, author of Living in the Shadow of Death, Tuberculosis and the Social Experience of Illness in American History. And we remember journalist Randy Schultz, who has died as a result of AIDS. He wrote the definitive history of the early stages of the AIDS epidemic. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Russia says it has convinced Bosnian Serbs to remove or give up their heavy weapons in and around Sarajevo. A NATO deadline is set for Sunday night for all forces in Sarajevo to turn in their weapons or face airstrikes. Richard Carruthers has the story.
The proposal Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic accepted came in a letter from the Russian president and was delivered by his special envoy Vitali Cherkin. Speaking in parley outside the Bosnian capital, Karadzic announced, "We think war in Sarajevo is finally over." Cherkin added, "I know Serb heavy weaponry is going to be withdrawn. 400 Russian paratroopers will be sent from Croatia to join UN forces in Sarajevo. Serbs will welcome Russian troops because of their religious and ethnic ties. Russia, which opposed the NATO threat of airstrikes, calling them illegal, can now claim a diplomatic victory. If Serbs pull back their heavy guns, it will be no great concession. Sarajevo was almost impossible to conquer, and the siege brought terrible publicity. Now Serbs will hold their current positions while releasing manpower and weaponry to fight elsewhere in Bosnia." For National Public Radio, this is Richard Carruthers in Zagreb.
The defense has rested in the murder trial of 11 Branch Davidians charged with killing four federal agents. None of the defendants testified. The agents were killed during a raid on the Davidian compound last year. The battle sparked a 51-day siege that ended when the compound burned, killing scores of people inside the building. The second of four defense attorneys began closing arguments in the World Trade Center bombing trial today. NPR's Maria Hinojosa reports.
Today, the lawyer representing Nidal Ayad addressed the jurors. Nidal Ayad has been tied to the World Trade Center case because he allegedly made phone calls and sent letters to a newspaper claiming responsibility for the February bombing last year. As has been part of the defense team's strategy, Ayad's lawyer tried to poke holes in the dozens of pieces of evidence the government brought against his client. Although there was evidence that Nidal Ayad, who is a chemist, did buy chemicals, his defense lawyer said he did so thinking it was for a legitimate business owned by a friend. The defense attorney also stressed that there was no direct evidence linking Ayad to the storage shed or apartment where the bomb was allegedly mixed. His defense lawyer contends that if Ayad was knowingly taking part in the bomb plot conspiracy, that he would have never bought chemicals using his own name. At the federal courthouse in New York, this is Maria Hinojosa reporting.
Journalist Randy Schultz has died. The author was 42. An assistant says he died at home in Sonoma, California, of complications related to AIDS. His best-known work was the book And the Band Played On. It described the history of the AIDS epidemic and the nation's response to it. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are down 18.5 points at 3,918. The Nasdaq is down 3 at 789. This is NPR. Former U.S. Treasurer Catalina Vasquez Villalpando has pleaded guilty to tax evasion, obstruction of justice, and hiding her continuing financial links to her former employer while she worked for the government. Villalpando was treasurer from late 1989 to early 1993. The obstruction conviction stems from an order she gave to a manager at a private firm. She ordered the destruction of papers that had been subpoenaed by a grand jury, which was investigating fraud at the Department of Housing and Urban Development. An insurance rating agency says the insured losses from last month's earthquake in Los Angeles may be $1 billion higher than originally estimated. Daniel Heinerfeld reports from Los Angeles.
Standard & Poor's Insurance Rating Service says the total insured damage from the quake may reach $3.5 billion. That's $1 billion higher than a forecast made earlier this month by the American Insurance Services Group, a trade association that tracks industry losses. The new estimate reflects data from 60% of the California property insurance market and assumes losses in the remaining 40% will be proportional. Standard & Poor's also reported that some smaller insurance companies that concentrate on the California market will be weakened by their quake losses and could face trouble during future disasters. However, several of the companies mentioned dispute the survey, saying it overlooks some key factors. One of them, Western Mutual, a small insurer based in Santa Monica, says that 90% of its quake losses are covered by reinsurance, and as a result, it might even have a profitable year. For National Public Radio, this is Daniel Heinerfeld in Los Angeles.
Rain is falling in Southern California. Forecasters say this is the start of a weekend of drenching rain. Sandbags are shoring up areas where mudslides could happen. Hills that were once covered with scrub and underbrush were burned clean by last year's wildfires. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is one of the leading women novelists of the Arab world, Hanan el-Sheikh. She writes about the alienation and inner conflict of women who yearn for more freedom than their culture allows. Her first novel, The Story of Zahra, written in 1986, has just been published in the States. It's about a young woman from Lebanon who goes to Africa to study in order to escape her family. She marries a man she doesn't love and is miserable. She leaves him, goes to Beirut just in time for the beginning of the war, and has an affair with a sniper. Hanan el-Sheikh is from Lebanon and went to college in Cairo. She now lives in London. Her novel, The Story of Zahra, is banned in several Arab countries, including Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Dubai, and Algeria. I asked her if she knows why.
They don't tell you why, and they don't acknowledge that it is banned. Only when the distributor and the publisher send the books to these countries, they return them back without any explanation. And then the publisher would know that they banned this book or the other.
Why do you think they've been banned?
I think because they think it's explicit, and they think that I don't portray the Arab family how it should be portrayed.
Because you have divorce, you have unhappy marriage.
I have adultery, unhappy marriage. The mother, she had a lover. And then the scene with the sniper, Zahra, my heroine, her relationship with the sniper. And then various things on human level, which they think I touch a very sensitive areas.
In your novel, The Story of Zahra, there's a very unhappy marriage that she enters into, and she leaves her husband after about a month. I believe your mother was divorced. And I don't think of divorce as being a part of Muslim tradition, but am I wrong about that?
No, in Muslim traditions, I mean, if there is a reason for divorce, of course women can get divorced. And in my mother's case, it was... My father was much, much older than her, in maybe 25 years. So, and she was forced to marry him because it's a long story, but he was married actually to her sister, and my mother was helping the sister at her place. And then her sister died, so my father they forced my mother to marry my father, so she will take care of... Her nieces, which were three, and so
she was basically filling in for your late aunt.
Yes, and my mother was 15 years old.
Wow.
Yeah, but she was very, very courageous for her age. I mean, my mother is illiterate, and yet she couldn't take it. She couldn't take the marriage with my father. So after she got my eldest sister, and then me, she decided that she cannot go on, and she. Had many battles with her family, and she won them, and she got her divorce.
What did she need to do to get a divorce?
Well, she had to be in front of a religious man and tell him that I don't like to be with this man because I was forced to marry him when I was very young. And the religious man said... He asked my father. My father is very pious, very religious, and also he thought that my mother cannot really live with him anymore. And he said, fine. He was crying when he said, yes, I'll let her divorce me.
What kind of stigma was there in the family when your mother left her father?
Oh, my God. In the neighborhood, it was, we were looked at and pointed at, my sister and I, saying these are the two girls whose mother divorced their father. And my family, my grandmother was weeping the whole time. It was like the biggest tragedy ever happened. And we felt it very much so when we were young.
Was your mother disowned by anyone in the family?
At the beginning, nobody talked to her for maybe 2 or 3 years. And then afterwards everything became fine. But of course, she cut relationship with my father.
What about you? Did you continue your relationship with your father?
Yes, we stayed with my father, actually.
Oh.
Yeah.
Were you able to stay in touch with your mother?
I don't know. I mean, my father, she didn't want us, I guess.
Your mother didn't want you?
No, I mean, she was in love with somebody else, and she married the one whom she used to love. So we stayed with our father.
So do you know what became of her? Did you?
Yeah, of course. She used to live around the corner. We used to visit her, and we were very thrilled that we have two houses.
Uh-huh.
Our house and my mother's house, and we still see each other and everything. She was my greatest inspiration in my life because she's a very funny character. Very, very intelligent, very crafty. I admire her very much.
Did you know a lot of mothers who were in unhappy marriages that were arranged for them?
Yeah, I do, but they weren't as courageous as my mother. There was a friend of my mother who was utterly unhappy, but she couldn't do anything. Her family wouldn't, you know, listen to her like my mother. So she committed suicide. She burned herself, and I remember that very, very clearly when I was very young.
Well, how did this affect your view of marriage when you were a girl?
Well, in a way, I wasn't thinking of marriage at all. I was thinking of something else. I was thinking, actually, in words and metaphors and images. I think I was a very sensitive girl, and I built my inner world through reading and through feelings. So marriage was far away from my thoughts.
Were there ever any pressures on you to marry someone who was chosen for you?
No, not at all, because I lived differently, really, than my mother or her generation. Because I was sent to schools, and after a very early age, I showed interest in literature. And at 18 years old, I left Beirut to Cairo to pursue my education. And in a way, you could say that I was living alone from that time.
When you were young, did you read anything that's at all like the kind of subject matter that you write about in the book of Zahara? In other words, when you were young, had you read anything from a woman's point of view by a woman that dealt with subjects like a loveless marriage, like sex outside of marriage, like abortion?
No, actually, I didn't. But let me think, to be very correct. I read Madame Bovary translated into Arabic. And I read Jean Eyre, also translated into Arabic.
Let me stop you here, because there's, you know what I'm going to say here. the husband in the story of Zahara actually masturbates to Jane Eyre. I guess there's a real shortage of what in the West would be considered very erotic material. No?
Yes, because it was the only book. Only book which he had, I think. And of course, I used to have this book when I was young, translated into Arabic. And there used to be a picture of Jane Eyre, which wasn't attractive at all. So while I was writing it, I was really laughing, saying, how could I make him masturbate on what work? I mean, he is in the village. It has to be Jean Eyre.
No, I'm thinking your novel, The Story of Zahara, has to do with a young woman who has premarital sex. She has a couple of abortions. She has an unhappy marriage. She leaves her husband. She has a sexual relationship with a sniper. It seems to me these are the kinds of subjects that you were probably brought up thinking that either you didn't do things like this, or if God forbid you did, you certainly didn't talk about it. And here you are writing novels about it. Was it hard to make that jump to writing in a public way about these very controversial and very personal subjects?
In a way, you are right. I often ask myself, when I was writing Zahra, I never felt I'm really defying or breaking taboo or taboos or whatever. But when people's reaction were, oh, Hanan, I mean, you are really courageous, you are really breaking walls, then I asked myself, because of these remarks, why did I do that and how did I have the courage to do that?
Well, let me ask you those questions. Why did you do it? And how did you have the courage to do it?
Yeah, I asked myself these questions. And I thought, because in childhood, I didn't think that society is giving me anything. I mean, I was deprived of my mother. My father was very pious, but at the same time has his own world, living in another world. And I didn't feel that I owe society anything. So I just felt like doing what I want and writing what I want. If I have a close-knit society, family, and I was, or if my father was educated and knew how to read and write, maybe I would have thought, oh my God, how am I going to write that? But since there wasn't any restriction, as if like, I was a free bird, so this is what I did.
Both your parents were illiterate?
Yeah, they are.
And that was liberating for you when you started writing because they couldn't read the book and frown on what you'd written?
Well, they were very happy that I was a journalist before I became a writer. They were very happy, very proud that I was a writer without knowing what I write. But my mother knows now what I write. She thinks it's funny and She likes what I write. People read to her. Sometimes she thinks I write about her, and she says, oh, but why do you portray me like that? Portray me somebody different, somebody really beautiful. And now in all her friends and neighbors, whenever I visit her and they come to say hello to me, they say, please, this is not for writing. We like to see you and we like to talk to you.
Right. What about your father? Is he still alive?
He is very old. He never knew what I write or what I've written.
So he still doesn't know what you write about?
No.
How come nobody's reading it out loud to him?
I don't know. He's not interested, I think. He is very old now. He is very sick. But before, he never was interested. And people, in a way, in the Middle East, in the Arab world, they just don't take things very, very seriously. Like, I wasn't taking seriously as a writer before. Only when I came to the West and my books became translated. And when Zahra was out, I started to be taken seriously.
But you've described your father as very pious, and I thought, whether he took writing seriously or not, he'd probably be offended by what you were writing about, had he known.
Yeah, maybe, but he didn't care. He didn't know. Besides, you know, I defied the society, and my father was very upset with me because I married a Christian. I'm Muslim. And I married a Christian, and he was very upset that I did that. But later, because he is pious, he said, we shouldn't hate what God may be better in the future for us. He just took it very piously and accepted it.
Did your father expect to choose your husband himself?
No. He never thought so, but he never thought that I'll marry a Christian, not a Muslim. But he knew, I mean, in my childhood, my father wanted us to really follow Islam and cover our hair, my sister and I, and pray. But he knew when we were 14 years old that we weren't doing what he wanted us to do, and he lost hope. And yet he didn't stand in our way. He just said, well, I hope one day you will become to what I want to preach you.
So when your father knew that you were no longer obeying the morality that he believed in, what were you doing instead?
Well, we used to be crafty about it. We were supposed, for example, to put the veil, not the veil, the scarf around our hair. We'll pretend we are, and then we will hide this when we go out of the house. We will hide the scarf in our bag, and then when we come back on the staircase, we will put the scarf back on our head, and we'll pretend that we pray. But one time we said, listen, we're not going to do it. And we've been lying the whole time. Of course, he became very, very furious and very sad, but he just gave in.
My guest is Lebanese novelist Hanan El-Sheikh. Her first novel, The Story of Zahra, originally published in 1986, has just been published in the States. She's also the author of Women of Sand and Myrrh. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Lebanese writer Hanan El-Sheikh. You went to a Muslim girls' school when you were growing up in Beirut. This was a grade school, I guess. But then you went to a more modern school, I guess, for the equivalent of high school?
Yeah, it was this eye-opener for me, really.
What was the difference between the two schools?
Oh, lots of differences. The first thing, the place where the modern school was near the sea. And for the first time in my life, I could see Japanese people, foreigners who were coming to the sea or to the American university. And I could see girls my age who were wearing beautiful clothes, speaking different languages than Arabic. And it's like the movies. And I was very much inspired by this. But at the same time, this difference in my upbringing and at the same time of what I was witnessing, I think it helped me in maintaining both worlds, and this feeling exile in both of them made me a writer.
Now, you left Beirut to go to college in Cairo. Was that your choice to go there?
Yes, my choice.
What did you want to go to Cairo?
I wanted to make myself. I want to be another personality, because in Beirut, I'll be the same person, the daughter of the pious father and whatever. And I wanted to create myself in Cairo.
No. After going to school in Cairo, you returned to Beirut. You were living in Beirut during the early period of the war there. Can you remember for us what the early days were like?
Yes. It was like a big pressure on the city. I used to love in the afternoon to just go into the balcony and look at the sunset and listen to the muezzins everywhere, the chanting, the sounds of the city. And this is no more happened during the war. As if the sky, as if nature has changed. It will be dark, pitch black dark, because there were no lights. And then you feel from all the buildings around you as if there are people, secret people, who are hiding in secrecy, and they're watching your steps, they're watching you, and they could fire a bullet any second. And also the streets, which you are accustomed to love, and you feel that there is a relationship between you and maybe the electric pole or a certain wall, a certain street wall, all of a sudden you feel that everything is against you, or they you don't relate to them anymore. I used to feel this heaviness, especially at night, and I used to get very, very, more than scared, very upset, very sad to see you, to witness the change of a city or a street which you are attached to.
Were you living with your family then? Or
no, I was married when the war broke. I was married, and I had a boy of 2 years and a half and a daughter of five months. And I thought that I really need to leave Lebanon, because I don't want to be in a place where I will be paralyzed thinking of the war and not be active and do other things outside the place.
What did you do to protect your children while you were in Beirut?
Like all the Lebanese, sitting at home and praying that things will finish very soon, because we couldn't believe that it will go on and on. But after 8 months, I thought I should really leave, and I left.
Do you have friends and family who are still in Beirut?
Yeah, of course. You know, I was from the first one who left Beirut.
Did that take a lot of explanation?
No, but they didn't understand my move, my decision. They said, "How could you leave your home? Your everything, I had work, I was a journalist, and everything was around me, family, friends, love. How could you leave everything and go?" And I said, "I don't want to submit to only one feeling, which is a negative feeling. I want life is too precious to just sit and watch war."
Have you returned to Beirut since the war?
Yeah, every year I go back to Beirut. And my latest novel, which is undergoing translation, it's about the war. It's like continuation to Zahra, actually. And it was inspired by my visits to Beirut every year.
What became of your house in Beirut?
Well, we left it. When we came back after 2 years, I saw shrubs in the middle of the room from humidity. It was the scariest really scene to see. I was so moved. I just couldn't believe that. I saw, the flat was intact, but you could feel that even the walls felt sadness because of what had happened and produced this green shrubs. And we left it, and we got something else instead. It was too much to bear the memories, actually.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Hanan El-Sheikh's novel, The Story of Zahra, has just been published in the States by Anchor Books. Her novel, Women of Sand and Myrrh, is also published here. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Tuberculosis was the leading cause of death in the U.S. in the 19th and early 20th centuries. The epidemic influenced our public health policies, as well as our attitudes toward illness and death. Coming up, we talk with Sheila Rothman, author of the new book, Living in the Shadow of Death, Tuberculosis and the Social Experience of Illness in America. Also, we remember journalist Randy Schiltz, who has died as a result of AIDS. He wrote the groundbreaking book about the early stages of the AIDS epidemic and the band played on. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. We're living in the middle of the AIDS epidemic while witnessing a return of the tuberculosis epidemic. My guest, Sheila Rothman, has been studying the tuberculosis epidemic of the 19th and early 20th centuries. She says that epidemic set the pattern for both personal habits and public policy and influenced American attitudes toward illness and death. Rothman is the author of the new book, Living in the Shadow of Death, Tuberculosis and the Social Experience of Illness in America. The period she writes about ends in the 1940s with the discovery of the antibiotic streptomycin. She told me why she wrote A Social History of Tuberculosis.
TB is probably the disease that's more intertwined with American history than any other disease. It really appears right around the time of the Revolution. It may have been there in the colonial period, but when you first really start to read about it, it's kind of right after the Revolution. And beginning in about 1800 and continuing into the 1920s, it was the leading cause of death. In the early period, from 1800 till about 1870, it was responsible for one out of every four deaths, which is rather incredible when you think about it. And it ran across class lines, across religion, young even more than old, women even more than men, rural as well as urban. So there was no one who was untouched by it. At one point, when I was looking at materials, I found that in 1852, when Franklin Pierce is elected president, his wife Jane, who came from a family where there was lots and lots of tuberculosis, was thought to have it. And no one's really clear whether she did die from it or not. The vice president couldn't be inaugurated because he was in Cuba trying to cure his TB. And the Secretary of State had just lost one of his sons, and his wife had died earlier from the disease. So you can see that it was really the disease of the country, the disease people feared most. It was called the Great Destroyer.
Until the bacteria that caused tuberculosis was discovered in 1882, nobody realized that it was contagious. How did people think it was spread?
They had a tradition of medicine that was really based from the time of the Greeks on a notion of the balances of the body. And they saw tuberculosis as arising from irritations, either in the environment or in the lifestyle of the person. And their idea was, how did you cure the disease? By rebalancing the body, which meant that a person had to change their lifestyle and their environment. And particularly for people who were in very irritating climates, which were considered for tuberculosis wet, damp, cold, like New England, and very irritating lifestyles, which meant indoor activity, sitting at a desk, not exercising your body, not getting out, not giving your body a chance to grow strong. Those were considered the problems. And so the cure became to try to change environment and change lifestyle, go to a mild climate, go to a soothing climate, begin to take up outdoor exercise, or begin to involve in an activity such as farming, botany, surveying for men, which would keep them out of doors.
The American West was thought to have restorative powers for people who had tuberculosis. Were a lot of people told to go west?
That is one of the most fascinating and probably untold stories of American history. We first begin to understand this, and it kind of trickles back to the West with the first explorers who go out there. And they come back, and they're telling stories of how when they get over the Rockies or they get onto the Southwestern Plateau, everybody's coughs dries up. And they begin to spread the word that this is the best place to cure one's consumption. And so people began to really start to go west. And it was thought that by even taking this overland voyage, going by wagon or going by horseback, you would strengthen your body so in the outdoors that by the time you got to California, you would be cured. And at least a third of the settlers of Colorado and a quarter of the settlers of California were people who came there for it to cure their consumption.
You write that in the days before doctors knew that tuberculosis was caused by bacteria, there were different treatments prescribed for men than for women.
That was one of the most fascinating parts of the book for me when I discovered that. It took me a while to really understand, until I had really read enough manuscript papers, what was going on. The optimal cure, as physicians saw it, was, as I said, to change environment, to change occupation, to, quote, travel for health. And that was one of the important markers. And I began to realize, as I read the papers, that physicians would often tell men to travel for health, but women weren't really told that. This may be one more example of so many that we've had. But as I got deeper and deeper into the papers, what I discovered was that the women and their physicians had kind of negotiated an agreement. The women's gender obligations were so strong, they were so determined to stay at home and to make sure that their children were raised properly, and as one of them would say, to train their children to be orphans, to make it possible for them to have the kind of training that would enable them to live in other people's homes, that they kind of worked out an arrangement with their doctors that they would cure, that they would do outdoor exercise and so on, as they were doing their domestic responsibilities. And so the physicians who shared their social values went along with this arrangement. So it's not a question of physicians not offering this, but physicians understanding the importance of one's social values and the importance of gender obligations and giving the women an opportunity to fulfill this.
My guest is Sheila Rothman, author of the new book Living in the Shadow of Death, Tuberculosis and the Social Experience of Illness in American History. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Sheila Rothman. After the bacteria that causes tuberculosis was discovered in 1882, doctors realized tuberculosis was contagious, and apparently that changed everything. It changed how society saw the sick. It changed the relations between the sick and their doctors and the sick and their community. What were some of the results of the fear of contagion once people realized that this disease was contagious?
Well, the changes were incredibly dramatic, and many people begin to think of the history of tuberculosis at the moment when Koch made the discovery. And many books which talk about this start in 1882 as if that's the point. And so when you look that way, the changes don't seem momentous, because it seems as if the building of sanatoriums began when we understood what tuberculosis was. It's only when you can understand this past history that the changes really become so dramatic. In the earlier period, people were allowed to travel. They were allowed to mingle. They were very much a part of the community. Once it was understood that the disease was contagious, suddenly all that stopped, and it stopped very abruptly. And the sick were isolated. They were told to leave their homes, leave the communities. They became outcasts, and they were sent up to live. And the poor went to live in sanatoriums in the American situation, and the well-to-do lived in what I called the shadow of the sanatorium. And the whole relationship between physician and doctor changed, whereas in this earlier period, I'm describing a kind of negotiated relationship. But after 1882, all that changes. The physician gives the orders, and the patient is much more subservient to it. Another thing happens, which again has very little to do with medicine, which is that beginning in about 1870, the number of deaths from tuberculosis begin to decline, and they decline. The decline has nothing to do with therapy. We don't really know why the decline happened, but it increasingly became a disease of the poor and the immigrant. So put contagion next to poor and immigrant, put heightened medical authority next to people who aren't educated and who don't often have the skills to respond, and you can begin to understand the dimensions of the change.
You describe some of the sanatoriums as being a cross between a prison and a hospital.
Yes, that was very distressing in that section of the book, particularly because we've all been raised with images of sanatoriums like the Magic Mountain. And we think of people kind of sitting there in a very bucolic setting, waiting, taking a cure, talking. It's a very intellectual, very refined environment. And the American sanatorium, and indeed most of the European ones as well, really weren't anything like that. They were set up for working class and for the very poor. And life in these places was often pretty grim. Many times people would be expected to work, but even if they weren't expected to work, there was a sense of having given up their autonomy, having given up their dignity for a promise of a cure. And it's really because of the way the disease was thought about and because they had a sense of themselves as being not treated well and not taken care of well. And in the narratives that people wrote about their experiences in the sanatorium, they have almost nothing good to say about the doctors and the nurses. All they can talk about were the rules they were forced to live by, was the fact that their lights had to be out at 9 o'clock, was the fact that they just had kind of no way of determining their daily life in any way. Everything was a rule. They were handed a book of rules, like one would expect in an incarcerative institution when they walked into the sanatorium and said, read all these rules and sign them. Sometimes they weren't even given a chance to sign them. And then from then on, 8 o'clock was this, 9 o'clock was this, 10 o'clock was this. One had to wait in bed for 6 weeks before one could get reading privileges or bathroom privileges. And they just felt incredibly confined.
I'd like to jump ahead to the present and ask you if you think that there are things that you learned in your study of tuberculosis in the 18th and early 19th century that have some application to the AIDS epidemic today?
When I began this book, I really wasn't looking for anything that had to do with AIDS, but sometimes it was a little bit uncanny what one found. I think particularly in the earlier period when men were told to travel for health, they would often go, and since they were the ones I wrote about were New England men, they would take a boat from Boston or Portland or one of these places and go south. They would follow the shipping routes. And they often all wound up living on a few islands like Cuba or St. Croix or wherever the routes were going. And there they would form kind of surrogate communities where they would spend the winter months. And their diaries talk about how they would nurse each other, care for each other, pray with each other. And many of them, in a very disquieting, unsettled way, found themselves attending funeral after funeral and then having to write back home to the family about how their brother, son, or nephew had lived their final days. And that kind of was very much, to me, had a lot to do with the way we think about AIDS. And when I dealt with the women, the whole rallying around that the community did around the sick and dying, I thought that that had a lot to say to us as we're beginning to think about these epidemics today and how to help people who are going through this.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the return of tuberculosis. The numbers of people who have tuberculosis are rising, and there's more and more cases of tuberculosis that is resistant to antibiotics, and that's very frightening. So there's an issue now that public health departments face about whether to use coercive measures on people who aren't taking their medicine. And, to either find a way to force them to take their medicine or to find a way to isolate them. What do you think are some of the biggest ethical questions we face now in treating tuberculosis?
I think that one of the points, and I think some of the public departments of public health are beginning to see this, is that one wants to try to make certain that one can do whatever one can without having to incarcerate people. Because once you get into the business of incarceration, you're always in that dilemma of, is this a hospital or a prison? How do we treat and detain? And I think this whole idea of directly observed therapy for people who won't take their medications when they should is a very important one, because it speaks to the fact that we understand the limits of what we can do with incarcerating people. But I don't mean by in that way to sound that this disease is not contagious. It's very highly contagious, and people should must, really, for the safety of others and really for themselves too, be taking their medications. But what's very important, and I think the departments of health are starting to do this, is to find as many strategies as they can to encourage people to take their medications, make sure that they can get their medications easily. Nobody wants to stand in a hospital line for 4 hours twice a week or three times a week to get their drugs. They're not going to do it. But if you can figure out ways to help them get drugs easier, if you can help those who aren't doing it, give them incentives to do it, that you might not have to set up these large incarcerative institutions with the problems that they have. And I think New York City has been very good about this. First, they had thought about the necessity for very large institutions, but now they've moved down to smaller institutions and to really only use them as a last resort.
Sheila Rothman is the author of Living in the Shadow of Death. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll hear news from Bosnia and about the announcement, at least, of a major Bosnian Serb withdrawal of artillery from around Sarajevo. A talk with the coordinator of UN efforts in southern Sudan about the crisis there. Many refugees fleeing fighting in Sudan's civil war are arriving at already crowded refugee camps. And we'll hear a report about AIDS in Thailand. Married men frequent prostitutes so often, it seems, that not only are the men, but their wives are now all at grave risk of infection.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. We end today's Fresh Air with news that we wish hadn't happened. Journalist Randy Schultz has died as a result of AIDS. He was 42. He made his mark with his writing and with the way he lived his life. Schultz was the first out-of-the-closet gay journalist to work at a daily paper. He was a reporter, then a columnist with the San Francisco Chronicle. His groundbreaking books covered gay issues. The Mayor of Castro Street was about the assassinated San Francisco supervisor Harvey Milk. And The Band Played On is considered the definitive history of the early years of the AIDS epidemic. Schultz's last book, Conduct Unbecoming, was published at the peak of the controversy over gays in the military. Schultz found out he was HIV positive in 1985, but he didn't talk publicly about his health until last year when he started getting sick. We remember Randy Schultz with an excerpt of an interview recorded in 1990, just after he'd covered the 6th annual AIDS conference. After that, he decided it was time to stop writing about AIDS.
I remember when I wrote my first story about AIDS in 1982, we got the majority of surviving AIDS patients in San Francisco in one living room, and I interviewed them. If you could, now you'd need Candlestick Park to get your surviving AIDS patients from San Francisco. I mean, it's changed so much. The story is very different in how vast it is. You know, when I first covered it, it meant going down to Castro Street. But within a couple of years ago, I was going to Uganda and certainly spending a lot of time in Washington figuring out how the government was responding. So much has changed in terms of the scope of the problem and, you know, the thousands and tens of thousands of people who are now working on it. What's depressing about it, or I should say what's angering about it, is how, in a very profound way, the basic storyline has not changed at all. That the story of AIDS remains a story of a huge problem and a response to it, which is not even remotely commensurate to the scope of the problem. And that continues to be the story.
You were, to my knowledge, the first openly gay journalist who was writing about AIDS and was affiliated full-time with a newspaper. And then you went on to become the most famous journalist who was writing full time about AIDS, and you were openly gay. So I remember when your book and The Band Played On came out, your book about AIDS, you were on this really big media tour. And when I saw you, I think you were bracing yourself for like every radio and television interviewer to say, "So tell me, do you test HIV positive?" I'm sure you got asked that a lot, and I want to know how you dealt with it. If you thought, you know, assuming that you thought it was really like not relevant to the story.
Well, yeah, I mean,
what was the way of telling people no? I mean, telling people that you didn't want to answer that. Yeah.
My basic way of is I feel that the only people who have a right to ask me that question are people going to bed with me, and so usually the people who asked me that question were guys. They were always, men with would ask if I were. So I say, well, you know, is that a, you know, you have a right to know if you're going to bed with me. So is that a question or a proposition? It's sort of like when somebody asked me if I'm a, this came up in some of the early interviews, they'd make a comment about, so you're practicing homosexual. And I always felt, well, after all these years, I really stopped practicing and I'm just perfect at it now.
Oh, one-liners can really come in handy.
Yeah, they always work.
So was there a kind of like last straw for you that made you say, okay, I'm going to do it, I'm going to stop writing about AIDS? I bet it's something you had really thought about for a while, but you finally reached the point where you said, okay, I'm going to do it.
It's funny because intellectually I never got burned out. It is an exciting story. I mean, it's very interesting. It's very sad, but it's very interesting as to watch, especially having covered it from the very beginning and watching it all unfold as an international historic event. But, I mean, it was really with me, it was never a conscious thought. It was just I started having horrible nightmares, and every night it'd be HIV nightmares and just horrible things. And then so when I went back, I took some time off, and I've been, both of my books are in development as movies, so I was in L.A. for a while, and I came back to San Francisco to cover the conference. The first night I was back at the Chronicle, I got a headache that lasted 18 days until I was done with the conference. And so sort of my body telling me things. It's just a level of intense burnout that I think a lot of people get with this and who have to deal with this disease all the time.
Randy Schultz recorded in 1990. Now we have an excerpt of the final interview we recorded together in 1993. I'd like to ask you something about what I imagine was a really big change for you when you were young. I recently found out in reading all these recent articles that have come out about you that you were the president and founder of your local chapter of Young Americans for Freedom, which is a very conservative group.
Yes.
And I'm wondering what you were like as a young conservative.
Well, you know, I grew up in Aurora, Illinois, which was at that time extremely conservative part of the country. They had not elected or voted for a Democrat since like in over 100 years. And so that was sort of the ideas that I was exposed to. And then also I did what a lot of, I think, people do when they're in junior high and high school, and I read a lot of Ayn Rand, which still has an impact on me in that I'm a very strong individualist. I think that influenced my thinking in a very conservative direction. And I think that's been real good. I mean, I'm obviously not that conservative anymore. But I think with people on both ends of the political extreme, either the left or the right, there's a tendency to dehumanize the people with whom they disagree. And I feel real grateful that I had the opportunity to be exposed to a lot of very conservative people, because you can see that they, you know, most of them are just like people on the left, where they sincerely believe that what they're doing is right. They're not evil people. They're not malicious. They just, you know, they just have different points of view. So I think it was very helpful for me as a journalist, because it let me see the importance of being fair and being balanced in coverage.
How are you dividing your time and energy between trying to really take care of yourself and not push too hard, between that and the journalist impulse to keep pushing to meet that deadline, to keep driving yourself as hard as possible?
This is a matter of great discussion between myself and my lover and my friends, because I'm basically a workaholic. Coming from the Midwest, I think I have that Protestant work ethic, and I have a real hard time slowing down. And basically, I think I made the decision several years ago that, you know, I could just sit around and sip cappuccino and coffee shops here in San Francisco, and perhaps live longer. But I'd rather, you know, have the life that I have be meaningful, and I find my meaning through my work. And so I'm probably going to keep on pushing.
Journalist Randy Schultz died last night at the age of 42 as a result of AIDS. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The National Book Critics Circle Awards were announced this week. On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, two winners of the award, Edmund White, author of a biography of French writer Jean Genet, and pioneering folklorist Alan Lomax, author of The Land Where the Blues Began. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next archive edition of Fresh Air.